This podcast is intended for investment professionals.
Hello, and welcome to our episode on managing risk in turbulent times. My name is James Kinsley, and I form part of the consultant relations team here at LGIM. Today, I am joined by Pete Bokes, a solutions strategy manager.
Hi, James.
And Femi Bart Williams, a senior solutions strategy manager.
Hi, James.
During this podcast, we will bring together some simple, low-governance steps large and small pension schemes alike can take to reduce the impact of market volatility without damaging the long-term goal of meeting pensioner payments. These are diversification, targeting appropriate hedging levels, collateral management, and managing currency exposure. So, taking each of these in turn, Pete, it would be great if you could start us off by outlining what diversification is.
By diversification, I really mean diversification across regions and across asset classes.
So how do you think the schemes can do so whilst keeping their governance burden down?
Sure. So for large schemes, they may have large teams that can look after the investments across multiple different asset classes. So that could run into, you know, tens, twenties of different asset classes there. That's the private equities, the emerging market debt, etc. A lot of these ones can be quite niche and can require quite a high level of governance. So the other option is to actually go and purchase a kind of a diversified fund that's offered by many asset managers. So this will take that burden away and offer you the diversification benefits with a lower governance.
And a couple of the asset classes there that you alluded to, the likes of high yield and property, are these things that we're seeing more and more schemes be able to access and actually seeing diversification, that spectrum widen over time?
It is, but it's something that the larger schemes have taken up more than the smaller schemes. So if we look at a kind of a trend from the 90s, and we look at, say, an equity allocation, particularly UK equity, this is quite a historic thing that a UK pension fund would hold a lot of UK equity. Now, luckily, that number has been reducing. And I say luckily, it just means that if you hold a lot of UK equity, that's a position that is against the kind of the market cap. A global market cap weighted equity fund would only have about a 5 or 6% allocation to UK equity. So holding more than that means that you're almost taking a position there. So luckily, the trend that we've seen is a diminishing or a reduced allocation to UK equity. But that's experienced more for larger pension schemes. Smaller pension schemes, so under 10 million or so, still maintain quite a high exposure to UK equity. So what we'd like to see there is that equity allocation kind of tilting more away, going into more real assets and high yield. But as mentioned before, given the governance burden, this may need to be done through a kind of diversified fund type structure.
Now, for many schemes, liability risk can be a major contributor to overall risk. And trustees face a balancing act of making up funding shortfalls whilst ensuring their deficit doesn't worsen. And often schemes will maintain an allocation to government bonds to hedge these liabilities. But what could DB schemes do better to manage these risks, especially during times of volatility?
I think the two things that schemes can do, we've touched on diversification, which is perhaps the concept of not putting all your eggs in one basket, but looking specifically at the liability risk. We know the main drivers of liability numbers being interest rate risk, inflation risk, and longevity. Actually, if we focus on the first two, most schemes can do something about their interest rate and inflation risk. It's a risk that they inherit partly because of the way actuarial valuations work. But given that those risks are basically existential in a pension scheme, what you can actually do is implement some liability-driven investments to actually bring that level of interest rate and inflation sensitivity down. I think most schemes, if you had no hedging whatsoever, then actually a move in, say, 0.5% interest rates could actually be as big an impact on the scheme as, say, something like a 25% equity move. So really, when you look at risks in that context, it is very often worth a scheme's while to put some liability-driven investment in place so that when your equities and your diversified growth funds actually do perform, you're not held back by the liabilities, you know, growing even faster, which is arguably what we've seen over the last 10, 15 odd years.
And so how do you think schemes could determine what would be an appropriate hedging level for them?
I think for most schemes, I guess I'd split schemes into two. I guess it depends on what your objective is or what your main risk driver is. So if you're looking to protect your funding level, so the assets, the value of your assets relative to your liabilities, so assets divided by liabilities, or whether you're looking to hedge the deficit, being the difference between the assets and the liabilities, assets minus liabilities, then you come up with two broadly different answers. So when you do all the funky mathematics, the I guess the minimum risk position for most schemes would be for those worried about their funding level, having a hedge ratio that is equal to their funding level generally minimizes the risk on that measure. For schemes who are looking at the pound difference between the assets and liabilities, so their deficit risk, to minimize that level of or that measure of risk, you'd probably be looking more towards the 100% of liabilities type level. But that gives you something to aim for. Not all schemes will get there overnight, but I think that gives you, you know, where the goalposts are in terms of your long-term target, depending on what your main driver of risk actually is.
And you alluded to there the making up deficits. And so for those schemes that have a greater deficit to make up, do you think there's any more efficient solutions that those type of schemes can adopt? Is there synthetic solutions that they can look to use in order to sweat their growth assets that bit more?
Yeah, absolutely. So lots of schemes have, I guess, capital efficient avenues that are available to them. So perhaps historically these haven't always been available, but they certainly are now available in a governance-friendly way. So one can use interest rates and inflation derivatives to hedge the liability risk, but you could also use equity derivatives on the growth side to actually get some capital efficient exposure to equities. So think of it as, you know, your deposit on a mortgage rather than actually buying a house for cash. That is perhaps the analogy between having physical equities that you pay for completely and, say, derivatives that you perhaps have a deposit for and you get a bigger exposure in return.
When we were talking about deciding what hedge ratio some schemes should adopt, and as we were talking about in one of our earlier points in diversification in looking at credit, so how much weight do you actually attach to the interest rate sensitivity of growth assets as part of the portfolio when setting your hedge ratio?
I think that's a good question. I think it depends on what type of growth asset we're talking about. I think if you're looking at something like equities, I think arguably that relationship is there in terms of it has some interest rate and inflation sensitivity, but you probably have to look over quite a long time horizon to see that. I.e., if you're looking to protect yourself from one actuarial funding cycle to the next, which is typically 3 years, that might not be long enough to see that really strong relationship between equities and interest rates or inflation. So you're therefore left with something that moves much more in tandem or much more in sympathy with interest rates and inflation. And in terms of growth assets, that could be something like infrastructure debt or some real assets, corporate bonds, that type of thing, where you have relatively contractual cash flows that can then be valued in the same way as your actual value or liabilities. But you do need something that moves in, you do need assets that move in sympathy with your liabilities over a relatively short time frame.
Right. And as you mentioned there, that when you're looking at this, that schemes are looking over the long term. And for those schemes that are looking to potentially the buyout route, how do you think that the volatility that's anticipated in the market can impact buyout pricing?
I think it's really about keeping your objective in mind. So I think if you are planning to buy out, I think having a portfolio or an asset portfolio that actually mimics the way a buyout pricing might behave might be a good idea, i.e. the volatility will affect your assets in the same way as it will affect your buyout pricing. So when you look at the two net of each other, then actually your net risk is much smaller. So I think in terms of managing that risk towards buying out, so it's really about aligning your asset strategy to your long-term objective, and you're much more, or you're much better placed to actually ride out that volatility then.
One of the things that you mentioned, Femi, was leverage. And as we alluded to earlier, as one risk is removed, another can arise. And the drawback of using leverage in the portfolio means it requires the scheme to maintain sufficient collateral alongside. And as we know, the the requirement for cash has only been exacerbated more and more as pension schemes become cash flow negative. Pete, how do you think schemes can better manage the need for collateral during times of volatility?
Yeah, during times of volatility, I mean, volatility or not, it is worth looking at collateral and kind of in particular cash flow management. Something that's been a hot topic now for the last couple of years or so, and quite rightly so. So when it comes to cash flow management, the reason that you allude to there is kind of cash flow negative schemes. So historically, pension schemes have had to pay cash flows to the pensioners. However, they might have had contributions from the employer that they've just been able to use. So it's natural cash flows that just come in from the employer and they can pay them directly out to the pensioners. Now, this means that they don't have to sell any assets. So it's a relatively simple problem. They're getting cash flow in, they pay it out. However, in today's age, the pension payments are ratcheting up. This is as pensioners kind of mature, you have to pay them their pension that they've been promised now for whatever, 20, 30 years or so. So the contributions coming from the company are no longer high enough to meet these cash outflows. So instead, you have to sell some assets or realize some of the assets. Now, if you sell assets during a period of volatility, that can be far away from its fair price. The reason I'm saying kind of fair price is there's a discussion to be had, not today, around whether an asset really has a fair price. But what we mean is if volatility kind of spikes for a couple of days or so and you're forced to sell an asset at a depressed price and it then returns to a different price, to a higher price, you may look back and kind of say, I wish I had a couple of days like wiggle room there that I could have held on and realized a higher price for that asset. Now, what you can do is implement a strategy that does not require the forced sale of assets. Now, that would be using assets that have contractual cash flows. So these are kind of credit-based assets. It might be credit. It could be real estate-based assets. But I think we'll start looking at credit. So if you buy a corporate bond, that corporate bond has a natural expiry date and natural coupons that come in. So the only real risk there is kind of default risk if you're prepared to hold that bond until maturity. Now, what you can do is you can use a kind of cash flow matching approach where you line up your credit assets with the cash flows that you know will be coming and falling due. Now, this gives you the benefit of not actually having to sell any assets because you receive these coupons or you receive these redemptions and essentially you can pay this directly out to the pensioner. And on top of that, of course, real estate assets or real assets may give you the extra diversification bonus on top of paying a contractual cash flow as well.
Traditionally, for income, as you alluded to, Pete, the schemes look to fixed income assets. And you also mentioned property as something that is a generator of income. Do you think there are any other asset classes or areas that schemes could utilise in order to generate some income?
There are a number of areas across the portfolio that you can generate income from. So the natural ones are the credit type assets, so corporate bonds, as we said, real estate assets as well. Real estate debt is a good example. However, it can literally come from anywhere. So this could be dividends, for example, from the equity portion of the portfolio. If those dividends are not reinvested, then what you can do is receive those as cash and pay them straight out to the pensioner. Again, it's just looking for any areas across the portfolio where natural cash flows arise.
Great. And how do you think schemes can look to incorporate this kind of cash flow driven investment strategy or cash flow aware investing type strategy alongside an existing LDI mandate?
So there are a number of funds that are kind of buy and maintain-y type funds. What we mean by that is just a fund that would go and purchase these credit type assets and hold them until the maturity. That's the kind of directive of the fund that you're looking for, or the objective of the fund.
I think the only thing I'd add is just touching back on the collateral point you made earlier. I think all of these things are about having a plan in place. So whether it is meeting your liability cash flows using a buy and maintain mandate or ensuring you have enough collateral, it's about having a plan in place. So, for example, your collateral could be mostly in a market neutral type pot. And you know where you go to as your first protocol for extra collateral. But perhaps you have a plan to go to your equities or your corporate bonds or whatever, you know where to go to for your rainy day fund. Perhaps much like many of us manage our monthly cash, you know your expected cash flows and you know how you're going to meet those, and you have your rainy day fund, so you know how to access more liquidity if you need to. So I think the issues of collateral management and liquidity are actually pretty intertwined.
And to your point that schemes have to or look to have a pot of collateral that they can call upon, a number of schemes have a deficit that they're looking to make up. What do you think that schemes can do with that collateral in order to potentially sweat those and generate a little bit more of a return from that collateral to help with that deficit?
Absolutely. I think schemes can look at a collateral waterfall, perhaps, is conceptually the easiest way to think about it. So you have the level of collateral that you are likely to need, and that perhaps has to be in cash-type assets so that you've got relatively quick and easy access to those. And for pots of collateral that you are less likely to need, that can perhaps be invested with a longer-term horizon in place, and that can go into some growth assets, for example. So I think looking at the horizon over which you might need different levels of cash might inform what sorts of assets you might be able to lock those away in to get a little bit extra return.
We've discussed widening the investment universe and having much greater diversification. But naturally, as a result of that, the portfolio will increase its geographic exposure, and with that comes currency exposure. How can schemes manage this currency exposure that becomes inherent with adopting this type of strategy?
So I think it's worth starting off by saying that currency exposure isn't necessarily a bad thing. I think some people see currency as a risk and a risk that should be taken off the table. Now, it's quite a difficult problem. It's a problem that really you have to take into account the kind of the asset exposure, the risk appetite, and the investment beliefs. But there are certain currencies that it's worth maintaining exposure to. The reason being that in the event of a downside scenario or a tail scenario, a lot of investors flock towards these currencies, so they can act as a really good tail hedge. Now, these currencies are historically the US dollar, the Swiss franc, and the Japanese yen. However, given that you don't know when these events are going to take place, given the terrorist nature of them, that there are other currencies, of course, that aren't necessarily terrorist hedges but will perform well in times that assets are doing particularly well. So it's also worth maintaining some currency exposure to those. So the kind of the conclusion that we quickly reach is that we maintain a kind of a 50% exposure to currencies.
And so, much like one of our earlier questions about determining what hedging level you should have in relation to your liabilities, what do you think that the level of currency hedging a scheme should adopt? Is that, as you alluded to, Pippa, do you think that should vary depending on a scheme's asset allocation or beliefs? Does it vary depending across large and small schemes?
So I think larger schemes could perhaps go down a more sophisticated route. You could go down the route of active currency management, etc. However, for the smaller low governance schemes, I think it's maintaining some currency exposure. So around that 50% hedge ratio is perfect.
Yeah, I agree. I think for most schemes, it's about, I guess we're in a world now where everyone's looking at their scheme as a unique set of assets and a unique set of liabilities. So perhaps in looking at your currency hedging level, as Pete quite rightly says, it's really about looking at the asset strategy holistically. So looking at your equity allocation, your bond allocation, etc. So the answer might potentially vary for different clients depending on your particular asset strategy. But it is perhaps unlikely to be exactly zero, or perhaps unlikely to be exactly 100% hedging. It's probably going to be somewhere in the middle.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much to Pete and Femi for joining me today.
Thanks, James.
Thank you.
We hope the key takeaways we have outlined for you are that by continuing to diversify across asset classes and region, targeting an appropriate liability hedging level, utilizing greater capital efficiency in managing cash flows and managing your currency exposure can all help to mitigate the risks that heightened volatility in the market can bring. If you would like to read the full article on managing risk in turbulent times, you can find the link in the episode show notes. That's it from us for today, so thank you very much for joining us, and we look forward to speaking with you again soon.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, you can leave us a rating or maybe even a review if you're feeling particularly generous on the Apple Podcasts app. It really helps new listeners to find us, and we're always on the lookouts for new ways we can improve. As a reminder, this podcast is intended for investment professionals and shouldn't be shared with a non-professional audience. This podcast should not be taken as an invitation to deal in legal and general investments. Any views expressed during this recording belong to the individuals and are based on market conditions at the time of recording and do not reflect the views of Legal & General Investment Management. Legal & General Investment Management is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. For full terms and conditions, please visit our website. And remember to share this podcast with your investment professional friends, colleagues, or even family members. And to find more great content from Legal & General Investment Management, check us out on Twitter, LinkedIn, and our website.